Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 280. I'm Steve Raker, your host this week, along with Kevin Whirlwind Ext from up in Canada.
It's a Thanksgiving episode.
I was going to say, happy Thanksgiving, now that you schooled me on your strange northern rituals. David, our regular host, is at New York City Comic Con, where we should be, Kevin. We should be walking around like cattle in that giant crowd.
And checking out the Valiant booth.
And paying top dollar for sketches. Anyway, Marvel Noise, we've got a Facebook page. We're at Marvel Noise on Twitter. And you can check us out on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk about the indie comic books we're reading. And Andrew, the LA Rabbit, usually our third partner in crime here, is in Jamaica providing storm relief to those ravaged by Hurricane Matthew.
Apparently he likes flying directly into the hurricane. Who knew?
A couple of things wanted to touch base with you on, Kevin, before we get into our feature of the show. One is, I know we often like to do this, often meaning once a month, talk a little bit about some of the collected editions that are in this month's previews. So I guess we are in October ordering for, what are we ordering for, December? That makes sense.
Yeah, probably.
And from the Omnibu line, we have a War of Kings Prelude, Road to War of Kings hardcover omnibus. This has got the Son of M and the Silent War, like those Quicksilver's a bad guy doing the bad stuff. You know, stealing his daughter and doing weird, taking the Terrigen crystals and all that business and having them all in him and all that. And it's got X-Men Deadly Genesis that, Brubaker's horrible retcon of the X-Men there where they brought us yet another third Summers brother, Vulcan. Sorry, Adam X.
Oh, jeez.
Then it also has the first 12 issues of the DNA Guardians of the Galaxy series, which is cool, and a bunch of Richard Rider Nova stuff from that time period. I like the back nine of this, but the first half of this is full of stuff that I'd rather not revisit.
Yeah, I guess if you didn't want a solo Guardians of the Galaxy volume and those other separate volumes like they did before, now they're just making massive chunks of cosmic thing ever in, like, multiple Omnibu.
Annihilation must have sold gangbusters and must continue to sell gangbusters as collected editions because they have just continued, like you said, to publish chunks of that Annihilation era, the Abnett and Lanning stuff, before Annihilation, after Annihilation, Conquest, War of Kings, all this stuff. They really are making sure all this is in big print.
Still no Nova Omnibu, though, but I expect that at some point.
Marvel Masterworks for this month is Captain America Volume 9, and this hardcover covers issues 176 to 192. It's the end of Englehart's run, so it's got all the Nomad, original Nomad, and Cap renouncing his country and the Shield and all that, and when that all wraps up, it kind of goes off the rails with a bunch of fill-ins before Kirby takes over for the next volume on the March to 200 and Mad Bomb.
Oh, I wanted to say Mad Bomb.
I beat you to it. Beat you to the crazy. As I'm saying, it went off the rails before that. I mean, that's pretty going off the rails too in some ways.
Zola.
There's a Star Wars Epic Collection of Clone Wars era material that was first published by Dark Horse. And there is a Monsters Unleashed Prelude trade paperback. I'm not sure what the prelude is, but this is a bizarre mix here. Again, I think I like the second half of the book, and I might actually buy it just for the second half of the book to have it laying around to read with my kids and stuff. But this has Fearless Defenders 8. That was the one with, like, Valkyrie and stuff, I think, after the Fear Itself.
Yeah, with Misty Knight.
Right. And Marvel Zombies from the Secret Wars, number one. Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, number one. Totally Awesome Hulk 2 and 3. Now, I know that had Fin Fang Foom in it. But then it also has a bunch of strange tales, Tales to Astonish, and Tales of Suspense, classic Kirby monster material in it.
You don't have that stuff in Masterworks?
Some, but here's a trade paperback you could wouldn't mind flipping open with the kids and bending back the binding on and stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe. Speaking of the Guardians of the Galaxy and all the Annihilation stuff, another interesting trade paperback collection is this Road to Annihilation Volume 1. It's got the Tom Lyle Warlock limited series from 1998. It's got five issues of Peter David's Captain Marvel Genus Vell series. Three issues from Dan Slott's She-Hulk run. And Jim Starlin's Infinity Abyss 1-6, the one that was like his return to Marvel that had Thanos coming back to character and in a meta way explaining, sort of retconning all of the appearances since Starlin had last handled the character, which was clever. And that actually has been reprinted as its own trade paperback within the last 10 years. It's all kind of dealing with the post-90s Starlin, Craig Anderson cosmic stuff and the pre-Abnett and Lanning stuff and kind of showing where those characters were. I mean, that Infinity Abyss ends with Warlock and Gamora off in like another dimension living happily ever after as a romantic couple taking care of this like cosmic being and helping to educate it and help it do its duty. And then when we next see Gamora, she's like crazy with the Annihilation stuff. It was one of those characterization things where Marvel's usually so good at connecting the dots from where a character was to where a character is next, especially when you read the old material like we have been recently. But that was just this didn't seem like the same character at all, and it's still hard for me to read Gamora like she's the Gamora I know. But anyway.
That's too random of a collection for me. Like, if they're going to do Captain Marvel, like, do Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Not, like, a few issues here and there.
It seems like they're doing the whole series of that Heroes for Hire, the John Ostrander, Pasquale Ferry stuff. They're up to issues 10 to 19, and it has Quicksilver, the solo series, issues 11 to 12, and the shared 98 annual that they had, the Quicksilver / Heroes for Hire. It's all this Wondergore high evolutionary stuff, which is usually right up my alley, but this one wasn't so much.
Plus it has Deadpool.
Of course it does. There's an Epic collection that is great unless you have all of the Peter David Hulk Visionaries trade paperbacks already, which I do. It's the Incredible Hulk Future Imperfect Epic collection. It's Peter David with Gary Frank, George Perez, Paul Pelletier, Salvador LaRocca, Stuart Immonen, Roger Cruz. It's got Incredible Hulk 409 to 419 and Annual 20, plus Future Imperfect 1 and 2, which was that prestige limited series. It's got Rick and Marlo's wedding, and even better, Rick's bachelor party. That's classic stuff.
I've never read this stuff. Because the Visionaries, you know, only went so far.
This is good. Well, the Visionaries went all the way through Peter David stuff, so it had all this.
They stalled out at, 390, I think. And then we got an Epic after that that picked it up.
Wait a minute, I gotta get up for a second here.
This can't be. It's right behind me, Volume 8. That's as far as it went.
Yeah, Volume 8. That goes all the way up to... What?
It would be like 18 volumes if it went all the way.
All right, I'm getting this then.
No, because the one they just came out with called Ghosts of the Past, that's the one that directly picks up right after the Visionaries, Volume 8. And that's so now it's like you got to keep going.
Yeah, you do. That's great.
It is. I'm glad like there was a long... like gap in between, but they eventually got to it. It's like the John Byrne Alpha Flight. Like there might be many years in between, but you know, they finally figure out a way.
And they're also starting a couple of more complete collections. One for Bendis's New Avengers and another one for Daniel Way's Wolverine. So it has like the Wolverine Origins in it and stuff, mini and the regular series. And speaking of Wolverine, they are finishing up the Larry Hama, Mark Silvestri Wolverine stuff in trade finally with a Weapon X Unbound trade paperback, issues 47 to 57 of the Wolverine solo series.
That must do well with the movie or something, because like otherwise I think they would just epic that.
Well, yeah, they were so close to finishing the volume, you know, and they had been complete collecting it kind of all along, calling it like the Silvestri Hama stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a great time for Wolverine. It really was a great series, and it's fun to see that stuff reprinted on clean paper, because a lot of the scratchiness of the artwork, it was Dan Green inking Silvestri, just did not come through on that paper, and also doesn't hold up well.
Yeah, I've read all that.
Speaking of not holding up well on the old paper and not having been reprinted on good stuff, finally, since Marvel Noise, episode 39, in June of 2008, my third appearance on this show, when I was calling for material to be traded that wasn't traded, I hope this is the beginning of finally getting the Kazar the Savage series reprinted from the early 80s. It's Bruce Jones and Brent Anderson. The first volume of this, but it's only issues 1 through 5, Kevin.
So you're looking forward to 5 more trades or something?
I don't care. I just, like, Brent Anderson's art is so, you know, it's Al Williamson-y. It's scratchy and sketchy. A lot like Silvestri stuff was back then, especially with Dan Green over him. So this, I mean, and on the old paper, it's just not holding up well, and I want to see this stuff. It's so, I almost wish it could be in black and white on crisp paper, but it's so good. These are a bunch of done in ones, the first 5 issues, and it establishes this new status quo for Kazar coming off of that early 70s stuff that I have covered in the past on this show. It's teaming him with Shanna as a romantic couple, which is great, living in the Savage Land. It's him and Shanna and Zabu. They're the main characters. And the Savage Land can be a lot like the Hyborian Age was for Conan, or the Wild West, or outer space, or underwater. There's some unknown parts to it. Kazar finds a path through to another area of the Savage Land he's never explored. They discover these, you know, so it has its own politics, and they don't know him there. And they discover these winged characters, humanoid people. It's really cool. It's some really good stuff. And just get started. After that, it's a few issues, and then it gets into the Belasco stuff. Really good. I love the series. All right. So you can order those up this month for December and January. You know, they like to pre-solicit things. Those stinkers. Kevin, you still like the Marvel Legends?
I still like the figures, yeah.
There have been so many figures, that waves of Marvel Legends, the 6-inch ones, that have come out, I don't know, since like the Civil War stuff from, that was the, you know, movie Giant Man that wasn't even close to the size of the old Giant Man Build-A-Figure. What was that, last spring, around the time of the movie? There have been 4 waves in the last 6 months, Kevin. That's crazy. Oh.
But isn't one of them a Spider-Man wave, maybe?
Yeah. Is that a problem?
Well, I usually kept the Spider-Man waves separate from the Marvel Legends waves.
But it's packaged exactly like a Legends. And
I always separated them because of how it was back in the day. And here, how they might not price them the same. Like, they'll say, oh, there's a sale on Marvel figures, but they won't consider Spider-Man like part of the Marvel figures, so it's just kind of weird. They also don't seem to stock the Spider-Man as heavily as the Legends, the regular.
There was an X-Men wave, X-Men getting some love for a Juggernaut Build-A-Figure, and it was brown-suited Wolverine, who we haven't seen in years, as far as I can remember, an updated Kitty Pryde, an updated Iceman, which is great because my Iceman's pelvis is all really loose, the old
one. Yeah, that happened to mine as well.
But I still have his ice thing, so I can put this Iceman on that ice sled.
Yeah.
A new Havoc with the, you know, tighter bands on his head and not doing a crazy scream like the old one. The Rogue from the Jim Lee era with the jacket, but not with the butterface like the old one from the box set.
Yeah, they kind of fixed the face, didn't they?
Another good one is an updated Phoenix, which needed to happen.
And that's like, yeah, that's a different hairdo type of deal.
And a Cable. And those seven figures make up the Juggernaut, and then there's an extra chase figure of Deadpool. That's the hard one to get.
See, I still haven't seen these at retail.
Huh. Those came and went. Then there was the Spider-Man wave, and that I barely saw. I just saw once. It just was quick, and the shelves were picked clean. And it's an updated Venom is the Build-A-Figure. And it's Spidey and the Miles Morales Spidey. And the figure is littler, too. It's to scale. It's funny. Finally, a good Electro. It's got a removable head, so you don't have to have it be the helmet you can put his regular crazy head on with the headdress.
Isn't that the modern, modern good Electro? Because I have an old classic Electro.
Is that, but didn't he have, like, Electro bolts that came, like, out of his wrists? Isn't that the one? From the Spider-Man line? That's the one that I had.
It might have been in a box set. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't have that one then.
Yeah.
But this one, so this is a much needed upgrade for me. There's a Hobgoblin, which I have a 6-inch figure from the old Spider-Man set.
Yeah.
But for those who don't, this is a nice sculpt. A new Spider-Girl and a Silk, which is nice. That's the one I bought from the set, and besides Electro.
Yeah, I would probably get the Silk.
What just came out is a 8-figure Build-A-Figure set, 8 figures for the Build-A-Figure, of Doctor Strange and, like, mystical stuff, and the Build-A-Figure is Dormammu.
Oh, that is nice.
It's not the Ditko Dormammu, though. It's like Kevin Maguire, 2000s, armored face, skull face-looking Dormammu, really heavily armored. But it gives you two different Doctor Stranges, comic book and movie, an astral Doctor Strange, Brother Voodoo, the Enchantress, which is great to add to my Asgardian part of my shelf.
Yeah. That's kind of a major character that they ignore.
Yeah, but I'm glad they've waited till at least they're going to put a good face on her, which is decent enough. There's another.
Yeah, I guess they figured out the faces by now.
There's an updated Iron Fist, but it's, in some ways, I think of it as like the latest Kari Andrews type, because it has interchangeable hands that have tape wrap on them, like bandage wraps around them, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's sad that I had to buy that white Iron Fist figure, but I don't think they're going to make Odin quite often.
Right, exactly. And there's a Nico Monroe.
Oh, that is so good.
You like that?
Well, I'm a pretty big Runaways fan, so... Yeah, right. Maybe of the original series. Like, I don't think anything has kind of hit as hard for them after that.
The bummer of it, though, and really, I'd buy the Nico Monroe figure and send it to you just to get the Build-A-Figure piece. But the figure I wouldn't want to get is the Baron Mordo. It's not Baron Mordo, it's Carl Mordo, and it's from the movie, so he just looks nothing like Baron Mordo, and it's like, no, I'm not having that.
Yeah, I don't like buying a lot of the movie stuff if it's different. I'm like, I'll just get the comic one, that's way better.
And I was still trying to grab those and see when I could catch them at a, you know, in stock at a discount rather than paying, you know, some secondhand toy handler, and all of a sudden I see yet another wave just came out, an Abomination Build-A-Figure, and it has movie Scarlet Witch, the Hail Hydra Captain America, a god-awful Captain Britain. He's like, he's really stocky and has these like big brown boots. It's not a good look. It's not the Alan Davis-y enough for me.
Is it the Hickman Captain Britain?
Yeah.
You're so many waves ahead of me.
There's a Wonder Man and Eel from the Serpent Society. So that's cool because we got Cottonmouth a couple of waves ago. So maybe they're going to slowly start, you know, when they first got Cottonmouth, it's like, what, one Serpent Society guy? What's the deal with that? But if they pepper each wave with a, you know, with a Serpent Society member, that would be cool.
Wasn't Eel teaming up with, like, the Enforcers at one point? Maybe we'll get Fancy Dan instead.
Oh, and the last figure from this Abomination wave that just came out, it was one of the ones I got, actually, besides the Eel, is the Iron Skull.
Iron.
Yeah, he's Red Skull, and he's all in iron, and he's got a little symbol on his chest where Iron Man's thing would be, and he's all mad.
Weird. Why didn't they just do the Green Skull?
Comes with a different head.
Interesting. I like these alternate heads, because we got the Chameleon and Hammerhead type of deal going on. Jameson?
Right. Yeah, that is cool. And there was that with a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and Nick Fury, too, where you could pop the heads and switch them around. And back when there was a box set for S.H.I.E.L.D., you could pop off Maria Hill's head and make it Sharon Carter. And you could pop off the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent's head, like the grunt soldier agent's head, and make it Dum Dum Dugan. So if you bought two of the box sets, you could have four different characters, which I think I did. Oops.
You needed that Maria Hill, I know.
Yeah, well, and that was the only Sharon Carter figure back then. They made one with the white jumpsuit. Fortunately, it's not Grandma Sharon Carter like now. I caught up on the X-Men books post-Secret Wars.
Oh, I hear they're good, Steve.
Not for me, it didn't. Listen, I mean, I won't spend a long time talking about negative things, although I do want to kind of just whip through what the books are and what they've been covering, just to let people know out there if they have been checking out the series or haven't, in case it touches upon some of their favorite characters or whatever. But I'm really... It stood out to me yet again how much I don't like this 8-month gap or whatever from the Secret Wars to when they pick up these series. It's like, these are characters I know, and you're just forced into it as if you haven't been reading the book for a while.
That's the mystery.
And there's nothing that you can pick up to read the I know, but it's I don't want to start. Like, if I left the books for a while, I might not come back to them. And this puts that in my face. Like, it detaches me from the continuity. And that's one of the things that I enjoy. I don't need to see every moment in between. I don't need to see breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then they keep referring to things that happen. The characters are obviously different. I don't understand the relationships between them. It is way more of a reboot than I would have liked.
So you're not reading Death of X?
No, I'll check it out. I'll read it.
Okay.
I'll read it. I'll see.
I'll read it on Marvel Unlimited, but I'm not making a special purchase.
Ditto. Yeah. The all-new Wolverine is the first one I checked out. It's written by Tom Taylor with art by David Lopez and now Marcio Takara, who used to listen to the show quite a bit, but now he listens to music when he... Not people talking when he draws, and... Probably not coincidentally, his art has really gotten good. So that sounds like a good strategy. But in All New Wolverine, we have X-23 as Wolverine. And she encounters in the first 6 issues, the arc is called The Four Sisters. She encounters this assassin clone of herself, who's already a clone. And then there are 3 more clones of various ages that of herself, and they escaped a government program that's now after them, yada, 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 right? And there's nanites in their head that are killing them slowly. You know, we've heard this all before, so many different ways and versions. But X-23 has to find them and befriend them enough to be able to learn what their cause is and whether it's just, and to decide how to deal with it and to help them out or not. Along the way, she fights the Taskmaster, which was pretty good. She gets help from Doctor Strange, but the clones that she's with touch the thing that they're told not to touch and release a demon, so then they have to fight this big demon on the street, and it's kind of was a little bit cliched there. And X-23 tries to steal an Ant-Man suit so that she can shrink down and go inside one of the clones' heads who's dying to fight off the nanites. And she gets intercepted by the Wasp, and then they fight. But after she pleads her case, they go in together. So it's like X-23 and the Wasp in a brain. You know, I love those shrink down and go inside the body stuff back from the old Neil Adams, you know, go inside the Vision. And then later when the Vision went inside Giant Man, all that, that's fun. Issue 7 is a team up with Squirrel Girl. It's like, you mean you can't talk to Wolverines like I talk to squirrels? It's pretty bad.
That sounds hilarious.
And Annual 1 is a rather forced team up of Spider-Gwen and X-23, where sort of out of the blue, they switch bodies, and then they have to figure out who they are and what the deal is, and then find the other part of themselves and work together to fix it. It's all right. It's all right.
It sounded like the TV series Orphan Black. That's what the closest thing I would compare it to.
It's the best of the books so far.
Oh, I don't know about that. But you know what happened with this series is enough people and podcasters were saying, this book is so good that I had to pick up the first trade. So
yeah, it's
it had that going for it.
All right. Old Man Logan is written by Jeff Lemire with art by Andrea Sorrentino. This book, awkwardly at times, I think, switches eras as you're reading through it. There's no storytelling device or visual device that really clearly delineates when they're switching times to the Old Man Logan future and our present time. And as far as I can tell, it's the Old Man Logan future, but before the events of the Old Man Logan story. So he hasn't, like, redeemed himself and gotten to the Hulk gang and taken care of them yet. He's still tortured, that whole bit. And he meets the Kate Bishop Hawkeye, and he meets Old Man Steve Rogers, and they show him Wolverines, our Wolverines, like adamantium encased corpse, where they have it on display. In this, like, shrine.
And we, that's going to be like a museum.
Yeah, I mean, so obvious that he's in there. But anyway. Then Old Man Logan hooks up with R. Storm and Teen Jean and the Extraordinary X-Men and joins the cast for that book. The second arc has him protecting this young girl that is the young girl that he eventually marries and would become his wife in Old Man Logan and gets killed by the Hulk gang. So it's like such weird and tortured circumstances, and he's going back and forth between his family getting killed and being in love with her as an adult and then jumping to her being like a preteen. It's weird. The time shifts, again, are disorienting. The third arc has Logan. This is a little more clever, I think. It has him encountering these Japanese warriors, the Silent Order. But he's met them before in his past, but our future. So, like, they think they're sneaking up on him, and he's like, I know, I've killed you before. Like, I know who you are. And he, like, the guy's, like, a masked guy, and he's like, you're this guy, and here's the deal, and here's, like, what your motivation is and everything. And the guy's like, what? So that's kind of funny, but it's still a bunch of warrior monks, and they're slicing him up pretty good. The Extraordinary X-Men book is also written by Jeff Lemire, so it has that continuity to it that he's got Old Man Logan on the team with art by Humberto Ramos, who I admit I'm not a fan of. And Storm leads this group, and it's Iceman, Old Man Logan, Teen Jean, Colossus and Magic, and a really weird, I mean, I can't believe how quickly they ruined him, Nightcrawler. It didn't take long at all. It's like he's like a Tim Burton version of Nightcrawler. He's like someone trying to draw a Chris Bacalo designed version of Nightcrawler, and it just looks, and it's like that's the only source material they had, so they really didn't know how it was supposed to look, and it just looks drab and bad. A lot of hair, a lot of mopey, a lot of gray. The base of operations for the Extraordinary X-Men is in limbo because they've got magic. They've got this place, X-Haven, and they're going to collect mutants and let them go there because they've got to escape the terrible Terrigen mists that keep circulating across the globe at ground level. without dissipating or rising up into the atmosphere, or anyone figuring out how to encase it or blow it away or anything.
Finally, someone gives voice to that.
Also, they fight Mr. Sinister, who, of course, has a clone of Cyclops, Yawn, who's dead.
Yeah, I was actually surprised by that.
They also have to fight in the underground lair the Age of Apocalypse's worst designed character, the Sugar Man.
Yawn. Ooh.
I hate him.
The Sugar Man. Oh, that takes me back.
And Magic, Ileana, she consults with Doctor Strange on some issues. Noticing a trend here? The team ends up chasing these mutant embryos that Sugar Man was genetically harvesting to the future. And then they have to fight Apocalypse's horsemen, and it taints Colossus, and he's even tainted when they come back. It's a part of a weird non-crossover X-line wide event. It was the Apocalypse Wars, and the events have nothing to do with each other except they happen to, during the same month, tell stories that had something to do in one way with another with Apocalypse in each of the books. But there's no connection other than that, which is odd.
And you don't have to collect them all.
This is true. This is true. Then there is the all-new X-Men.
This is a good one, Steve.
This is written by Dennis Hopeless with art by Mark Bagley.
I think if you like Wolverine and the X-Men or some of his other work on the Avengers Arena or that type of stuff, you would enjoy this book with more teen characters and all that.
It's the teen X-Men minus Teen Jean, because she's an extraordinary X-Men, and Kid Apocalypse and X-23. I just don't like the time-displaced X-Men. I just don't.
But they're road-tripping. You know, an X-Force was road-tripping?
I know.
If you're into that type of thing, I think this is all right.
The first arc has them encountering a Chicago gang of mutants, the Ghosts of Cyclops. And then they go on the road trip, and that seems to be the direction of the series. There's this whole Angel and X-23 relationship, and she's the battering ram of the group. She sees that as her role. She's got the healing factor. She can go in there, get herself all burnt up, get herself all smashed up, whatever. And Angel can't take watching this girl that he's sentimental for or having a romantic relationship with, seeing her get all trashed, and she doesn't need help. And she can allows herself to get trashed, but it wears on him and puts a strain on their relationship. They fight the Blob in Paris. Teen Clops gets hit by a car and taken hostage by Toad and tortured. The horrible Toad. Teen Beast visits, guess who? Doctor Strange. to see if he can help them return to their own time. And it's like, nope, you got to figure it out for yourself. That's almost a direct quote. And Beast and Kid Apocalypse accidentally travel back in time with an artifact that Strange gave Beast to be able to divine the future. I don't know why he would do such a thing, but he did. And this is their Apocalypse Wars crossover, non-crossover storyline. And Beast and Kid Apocalypse meet the real youth Apocalypse, who's like, hey, you got a mouth, you look like me. And the Beast gets gutted by these sand people, and they got to try to get back. And
Robo Mouth.
The last book of the X titles since the Secret Wars, other than X-Men 92, but I'm talking about kind of the current continuity stuff, is Uncanny X-Men. And that's written by Cullen Bunn, with art first by Greg Land and then Ken Lashley, and it seems like they're alternating arcs, perhaps.
Yeah, this one is, I think you can figure out what you're going to get just by the creative team.
It is Magneto. Magneto-led team. He's created his own team of X's. It's Psylocke, the now-so-very-good Sabretooth. Oy. And Generation X's Monet, which is crazy. I mean, that's a crazy character. Crazy. Originally, she was supposed to be like Asperger's and stuff, and like on the autistic spectrum, and she's not anymore, apparently.
She was really good in Peter David's X Factor.
Right. That's, but I, even there, I couldn't get over like what happened to what she used to be. I missed something along the way, but I dropped out of the Generation X generation a long time ago.
Well, wasn't she like one of those problem characters where they didn't quite know what to do with her, and exactly. They kept on retconning things left and right?
Yep, that's where I got lost. And also on this team is Archangel, who's this like drone-like, soulless, robotic, almost catatonic version of Archangel, separate from that Warren character, who's the human version. And then also secretly part of the team, which bothers Psylocke when she finds out, is Mystique and Phantom X. And the whole book is kind of hinges upon this whole, will Betsy Psylocke trust Magneto or not? And as she learns more of his secret stuff, is she going to go along with it and accept it? And how much is she going to take? Or is she going to stand up and say, no, that's not going to work for me? Apocalypse's Dark Riders return.
Wow.
And they are hunting mutant healers, including Zorn. Magneto blows up Genosha, which I thought once just got up and walked away, didn't it?
That Madripoor?
Oh, yeah.
Did Genosha do that as well?
You're right, it was Madripoor. Thanks for setting me straight.
There we go. Good thing I'm here for something.
Gotta keep these X-Islands straight.
Yeah.
And Psylocke and Magneto finally deal with this whole weird Warren Archangel duality dealio thing. Thank goodness, too. Monet and Sabretooth help Callisto with these abductions of Morlocks, which is funny because Sabretooth loves the Morlocks and vice versa, right? It turns out who's behind it all but Monet's brother, an empath. So it's like, now I understand why Monet's on the team. Then the Apocalypse Wars storyline hits, and Apocalypse's son Holocaust, I mean Genocide,
don't you mean Dark Nemesis?
Yeah, they've changed his name so many times because the Holocaust name I guess didn't go over so well.
Wonder why.
Well, he's behind the whole Warren Archangel thing, and he has to be dealt with and is finally dealt with, which is great. About time. Angel gets merged, so he's, you know, that's finally that. Magneto's X-Men, it turned out, are, like, in bed with the Hellfire Club, where, like, Monet and Magneto are the White Queen and King, and they want Psylocke to be the Black Queen. She's got to think about that. And then
didn't they, in the 90s, didn't they sort of have something like that going on, too?
Yeah. And then the big bad for the next arc, it looks like, is going to be Exodus. I thought we'd totally seen the last of.
Yeah, but all these characters, they bring me back. I don't know if it's a good bringing me back, but I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, those characters. So, is Strife going to show up soon, too?
Yeah. On the X-Books, they're mediocre. There's not one of them that really jumps out at me like, ooh, this is good, or I'm on board, or I feel like I'm brought up to speed, or... I feel very detached from them, even being able to read them all like this and try to catch up on where they're all at. It still seems incomplete to me. It's been a long time coming. Another aspect of Marvel culture, especially in the 1990s, just ask anyone who was reading comics between 1990 and, 98 maybe, is the Marvel cards that were released from Skybox and Fleer and throughout those years. I think the first set was in 1990. These were a hoot.
These cards. The first set, I happened to look some of them up online. I just wanted to see what the general reaction was to them, like nowadays, if people are like liking them. But I guess the first set is the one that people most like still.
It was very first setty, but I was 20 in 1990 when the first set hit, and in college. And I collected football cards, NFL cards to some extent, and was just getting back into comic books when the first Marvel Universe set hit the shelves. And just to give a quick overview, Kevin, of kind of the scenario, like company-wise, the timeline, the first set hit in 1990, and the company was Impel, who became Skybox in 1992.
This is so weird.
Okay.
And yeah.
In 1992, when Impel rebranded itself as Skybox, it was in one of Impel's card sets for baseball was Skybox Baseball. You know, Skybox being like a sports box, you know, luxury box. They decided to make their whole company that name. That same year, 1992, Marvel buys Fleer, the card company. Fleer, who made the first bubble gum, you know, back in the 20s. They made the first, and it was pink, and that's why everybody makes pink bubble gum. It's because of how Fleer did it, double bubble. So Marvel buys Fleer, but the Marvel Universe license for the cards is still with Skybox for another year through 1993. So in 1994, we get the first Marvel-related sets from Fleer. And who was running all of the trading card operations at Fleer at the time was Bill Gemas. That's where he comes into the equation and ends up being Marvel's editor-in-chief and beyond. When they begin publishing the Marvel cards, he is already getting his arms into other operations and needs to bring in somebody to handle the Marvel card division. And he brings in a guy who used to work for Marvel, Dan Buckley, who's now Marvel's president and publisher. Okay, so they both came from Fleer publishing Marvel cards. He and a fella named Michael Passiulo, who was basically a fresh grad a couple of months out of college with a marketing degree, answers an ad in the paper. And to this day, he works as a marketing senior vice president for Marvel Studios and TV. So all these guys are now upper level in Marvel Entertainment, which is interesting, all coming from Fleer. In 1995, Marvel buys Skybox and then merges it with Fleer to make Fleer Skybox International. But the very next year is 96 when the implosion happens and Marvel declares bankruptcy and all of its subsidiaries, including Fleer Skybox International. 2 years later, Marvel sells off Fleer and Skybox to a corporation, a father-son-run corporation, but they ended up folding 7 years later in 2005. Upper Deck, another card company, bought the Fleer name in 2005 and for two more years put out cards with the Fleer name on them, but the last Fleer cards came out in 2007. Crazy, right?
Yeah. That's a good history, though.
There you go. And what's funny is thinking, too, these guys, they didn't have the internet back then, and they had the license, but it wasn't like it was Marvel producing these cards in-house, so the characters in these card sets were chosen from this very small design team of Buckley and Passiulo and a couple of other guys, is like their memories and their favorite characters, and they use their own collections to write out the information on the back, including, like, you know, if they would have to run to their LCS and buy back issues to find information on certain characters to be able to write the card blurbs on the backs, which is hilarious.
Don't tell me they counted the number of wins, losses, and ties. That's what I want to know. They always seemed inaccurate.
Fleer's also from the card company that kind of moved over into comic books, and one influenced the other, was the printing and design capabilities of the cards and on the different paper stocks. And what they were doing were far beyond and ahead of the curve innovation-wise for, like, the gimmicks and stuff, the die cut and the holograms and the foil. You see where I'm going here, right? So
yeah,
these end up being used for all the special covers for Marvel. A lot of these techniques. Can we do this on a cover? Let's do that. And the guy who is in charge of Fleer's printing them, Jim Boyle, now does the same for Marvel. He's in charge of printing for Marvel. So again, another Fleer guy who's now an upper at Marvel. The backs of the cards would have different hooks as well. When they were coming up with the lines, they'd have different facts and ratings and, like you said, well, wins and losses and stuff, which is funny that they started out with sports-related things, trying to keep with the sports theme. Also, should mention that the artists that were chosen, and I'll mention as we go through some of the sets, but the art director, Jennifer Caudill, once the ball got rolling, she was amazing at assembling talent and bringing in people from outside of comics who had never done work for comics to do the cards too, as well as people known in the industry. And this whole division, until the implosion, was really profitable. And from an interview with Paciulo and Buckley that's on Marvel.com, they were basically saying that the negotiations to hire artists were basically, what's your rate? And they were accommodated. And that the artists were very, very well accommodated for the work on the trading cards, that it was a real good gig to have, which is cool. Because there's some good stuff here.
Yeah, I would say the first set is the most classic looking to me.
Sure, and that was the inaugural set, 1990, Marvel Universe Series 1 from Impel. There was 162 cards plus 5 holograms. And it kept that sports, like you said, the stats and stuff. They went with win percentages and wins and losses and ties and battles fought and height and weight stuff with their fun facts. There were 51 heroes, cards 1 through 51. Then 52 to 81 were villains. 82 to 88 were rookies. 89 to 123 were famous battles. 127 to 136 were most valuable comic covers. 137 to 148 were team pictures, again with the sports in mind. 149 to 160 were Spider-Man Presents, which were these kooky, reminds me of the old Stan Lee written captions for like the old Marvel stickers back in the 70s. But it's like Spider-Man doing bad tongue-in-cheek comedy. And then card number 161 was a Stan Lee Mr. Marvel card.
What? No Jack Kirby card?
The holograms were the same card art as the regular card art, just done hologrammy, like Cosmic Spidey and Silver Surfer and Wolverine and Magneto and Spidey versus the Goblin. The artists weren't credited and there were no signatures visible, but a bunch of them were done by Mark Bagley, Walter Simonson, Paul Ryan, Art Adams, and Ron Frenz. There'd be a banner across the top with like the category if they were superheroes or supervillains, and then their name was in sort of like a parchment caption banner. But some real good art here, although, you know, not full bleed or anything, but some classic images. You know, Friends could give you that, you know, John Buscema look. The second series was Marvel Universe Series 2 in 1991, also from Impel. Also, 162 cards with 5 holograms. Heroes, villains, arch enemies, weapons, legends, who are the dead, rookies, again, teams, and then there were 3 cards that were, like, explaining what the power ratings were and a checklist, but the next series and every series after that, the explanation of the power ratings, like the key, would all be on the inside of the wrapper.
Mm. So did you use your checklist?
If I had to.
Okay.
The first one was clean.
I have a clean one. For the first 2 series, I just marked them off. I didn't care. And the third series, I'm like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Here we got art from, like, I mean, there's Ron Lim, Silver Surfer versus Galactus. Ron Frenz, Eric Larson, Jim Lee, Art Adams, Paul Ryan, Tom Morgan. Some real nice stuff in this set. The hologram cards were new art for the hologram rather than just reprinted. And
some of them really stick out.
I like the weapons category. It's cool to have like a Mjolnir and Cap shield and stuff.
You know, this might be where I saw some of these things for the first time, like whether they're weapons or covers or whatever, because where else are you going to see some of this stuff?
The Infinity Gauntlet, Ron Lim drawing it, of course.
I just laugh at some of these, like, Punisher's arsenal or his battle van, and we're like, ooh, his battle van!
91, the rookies are Darkhawk and Sleepwalker and X-Factor, or X-Force, I should say.
But who... Remember looking at some of those and being like, who are all these people? Like, you're trying to figure out who is who. I know the X-Men one famously had Sunder, and we're like, who is Sunder?
Sunder only happens when it's raining.
I guess so. Sunfire?
What was interesting about this set, too, was they kept all of the names, like, in homogenous type in the lower left-hand corner. And in the way upper right-hand corner, they would have what type of card it was, which led to, it seemed, bigger card art. But again, all the cards had that very homogenous look with the same border and that same type and color of the characters' names, the logos.
Daredevil fights a lot of people in these versus cards.
Hey, he was popular at the time.
It's like Daredevil versus Kingpin, Daredevil versus Punisher, Daredevil versus Wolverine. I'm like, really?
Also from Impel, Marvel Universe Series 3 in 1992. I'm getting one set a year here. By now, Kevin, I'm just pre-ordering and buying a box.
Oh, see, I only...
Forget cards. Forget loose cards. Yeah. I want them all from the same box, because you know what they did, and good on them, is they would make sure, pretty for the most part, I can't remember any times that it wasn't the case, but you would at least get the entire base set of cards in one box, plus some chase stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think I only ever got two or three boxes. Like, I wasn't the one buying them, but I remember them being sold... the cards at, like, the corner store, which was awesome. So I would just, like, get a few packs or whatever.
Series 3 in 92 was 200 cards with 5 holograms, given us 70 cards of heroes. 71 through 100 was team-ups. Then 39 cards of villains, rookies, cosmic beings, yay! Origins,
yeah, that was awesome.
Teams, and wars, as well as milestones before a checklist. And I liked it with the cosmic beings because the border of all of the cards was like airbrushed cosmic, like, computer backgrounds, but they connected, which was cool. You could just line them all the way up, line them all the way across your floor, and they connect up.
I like the power ratings on these, how it's just like 1 or 7. Or it just is not applicable. It's just like, how can you really rate guys like the Celestials or Eternity or whoever? It's just like
off
incalculable.
The art on these cards, too, would give you a figure. Like, there would be an odd shape that would contain some drawn background that wasn't like the computer border. And then the character would be overlapping and busting out of that shape into the border material. So it was kind of neat. It gave you that kind of, still gave you a comic drawn background to some extent, but the cards really had a real cosmic feel to them.
I also like these sets because they're sort of like giving you a yearbook of sort of like what happened that year in comics. What characters went in and out of the sets?
You bet. The artists were uncredited here, but the signatures are often visible. It's Tom Morgan, Ron Lim, Greg Capullo, Eric Larson, Brett Blevins, Sam Keith, Lee Weeks, Paul Ryan. Mark Texeira draws Ghost Rider, and Dwayne Turner draws Cage. Mike Manley draws Darkhawk, and Dennis Cohen draws Deathlok. Silvestri and Jim Lee both on it as well. In 1992, Impel branched off with a second set in 92. We'd get a third. And this was from Impel. It was X-Men Series 1.
Yay! I bought these too.
100 cards and 5 holograms. I also bought these had the box, had the set.
Or I was just getting duplicates from people that are like, that's the fifth one you've seen in that box. Give me one of those.
This was all Jim Lee art framed in a pattern border with the X in the lower right-hand corner and the character's name in the lower left with like a little flag with the card type in the upper right-hand corner.
I believe they also reprinted these cards at, like, comic size, like as a poster book type of thing.
Yes, they did it. It wasn't a poster book, but, you know, it was like a pinup book.
Yeah.
It was two issues, I think, even. And these had a heroes, a villains category, teams, X-Men, which I thought was funny, allies, and then for the first time they explored the fact that people were collecting these in binders. All the binders that I have these cards in are all University at Buffalo binders because I was in college at the time, so they're all school binders. It's funny.
Guess what I have mine in, Steve? It says Ultra Pro Comic Card Album.
Nice.
Like, I'm sure you would get some kind of like albums now for your cards or whatever, but I don't know what they would be in. Like, I can't imagine them creating this type of binder nowadays. Like, maybe you would stick them in a Magic the Gathering binder or something.
I've got like 6 3-inch binders full of these cards. They innovatively thinking about the 9-card page. Cards 91 through 99 were the Danger Room, and it was a 9-card image. The 9 cards in your binder would create one image, which I guess now is, you know, secondhand to these comic cards. But back then, this was innovation. This was cool. And it kind of evolved from the connecting backgrounds of the series before. Now it's like, well, why don't we connect the art and make one big collectible image, which looks great. This year, 92, was when Impel became Skybox. So the last series from 92 was now from Skybox. And it is the Marvel Masterpieces 1992. 100 cards with 5 chases. It was 99 cards of heroes and villains all mixed and a checklist. All full bleed, painted portraits by Joe Jusco.
Yeah, these were really nice. I remember looking at these going, what?
Yeah. And these were also reprinted in comic form. I think it was a 4-issue limited series, actually.
Mm, these probably reprinted better than the Jim Lee stuff, because sometimes that blown up, you were just like, what? I can't even see the image, really.
That's true. I love Jusco's stuff, though, and I've been fortunate enough to meet him a few times, and he's a really good guy. In 1993, with the Skybox company name, we got Marvel Universe Series 4, which was 180 cards with 10 chase cards.
I sort of bowed out. I only have like maybe a few pages of these. I don't know why I never completed this.
I like this one. This is a good one because cards 1 to 135, which encompass 15 binder pages, they're all 9-card images.
But isn't it weird theme. Some of the combinations, like Moon Knight is beside Siege?
Yeah. But they were just trying to combine families to some extent. I mean, you've got a Cosmic one, New Warriors, 3 different X-Men related ones, kind of one with magic characters, a Spidey one, Fantastic Four, West Coast Avengers, Alien Races, Marvel UK. Remember when there was a Marvel UK?
Yeah.
Then 136 through 144 were unsolved mysteries of the Marvel Universe. Like, who is the sixth member of the Infinity Watch?
Oh, did they figure these mysteries out by now?
Let's see.
Okay.
All right. The origin of Wolverine. Check. The origin of Cable. Check. The face of Darkhawk.
I think so.
Undetermined or check?
I'm sure they did that because they did everything in that book in 50 issues.
What the true nature of the Dan Ketch Ghost Rider was? Check. The fate of the X-Men. What's this? After...
You mean Onslaught and Gambit being a traitor in that? You mean?
Yes, exactly. All right, so check.
Yeah.
The face of Doctor Doom. Check. The sixth member of the Infinity Watch. Check.
What? That was a story?
Oh, for a long time, too. When Adam Warlock first got the gauntlet to help him be a good supreme being, he cast out all of his good and evil so he would be neutral. Mm. And the evil was the Magus. That's how the Magus got reconstituted, and that's where we got the Infinity War. and the good was the goddess, and she was the reason for the Infinity Crusade. It was his good side and his bad side, each coming back as the next nemesis. But when he had to give up the gauntlet, he agreed to separate the stones to various keepers, so that Drax got the strength, you know, the power gem, and Pip got the teleportation gem, and Adam got, you know, the soul gem, of course. And the mystery was who got the reality gem. And Moondragon got the mind gem, you know, that kind of thing. And it ended up being Thanos. And that was kind of the Thanos isn't such a bad guy when he's able to handle responsibility on a cosmic nature. Yeah, that was really cool, actually. So, yeah, so all those mysteries are solved.
You ever think about if they, like, nowadays doing a set, what they would put in some of these things? Because I remember, like, creating, like, lists for some of these things, like, after, like, I wasn't getting the cards, or even for my own characters. I'm like, let's continue this as if it was just going on. So...
The chase cards in this set were 9 red foil cards drawn by Rick Leonardi of the 2099 characters. We're at that time of the Marvel's publishing, Kevin. The cards in this set were drawn...
Was it Serpentina?
Let's see.
And I had... I'm trying to remember.
I definitely had them. The Specialist, Deathstrike, Tiger Wild, Ravage, Punisher, Doom. I guess I didn't have all of them.
Yeah.
I had 6 of the 9. These cards were drawn by, other than those chase cards that were Rick Leonardi, drawn by Stephen Butler, Ron Lim, Derek Robertson, Joe Mataria, Dan Panosian, Art Thiebert, Tom Morgan, Ron Frenz, Lee Weeks, Jeff Johnson, Steve Lytle, and Liam Sharp with some really nice cards. And the battle cards were drawn by Pat Broderick, Jeff Isherwood, George Perez, and Jarvinin. Also in 93, Skybox published X-Men Series 2. 100 cards plus 13 chase cards, which pretty similar categories. Archenemies, yeah. Heroes, villains, teams, and 9 cards of the animated TV series. They were cartoon at the time and pretty popular, and toys were selling and stuff. They also played around with connecting cards, and they would have 2 cards connect with each other, and then 3 cards longitudinally, like along the outside edge of the page. They were playing around with design, which I'm sure they had fun with in the design meetings.
Did you see the Dark Riders in there?
Art by Greg Capullo, Alan Davis, Andy Kubert, Joe Quesada, Brandon Peterson. Good stuff. Except this gaudy 3D X-Orb in the lower right-hand corner. They're like so proud of their computer 3D graphics, they had to shove it in our faces on every card. Also in 93, we got the second series of Marvel Masterpieces from Skybox. This was 90 cards plus 8 X-Men 2099 Dyna-Etch chase cards.
See, I don't think I liked this series as much, but I really liked what they did with the back, with all the comic images behind the text and everything.
Mm-hmm. It's full bleed painted art with the foil name stamps across the bottom. And yeah, the backs of the cards are great. The big logo, colorful logo and stuff, and classic art, which was credited, which I loved. The last Masterpieces had was all Joe Jusko, which was great, but this we got paintings from Jim Steranko, Joe Jusko, Dan Brereton, George Perez, Bill Sienkiewicz, Joe Phillips, Julie Bell, Mike Kaluta, Brian Stelfreeze, Mike Zeck, Tristan, Dave Dorman, Ray Lego, Tom Palmer, who's a fantastic painter as well as an inker, Glenn Fabry, Brett Blevins, really good stuff. With 93 in our rearview mirror, the license to publish the Marvel cards is finished up with Skybox, and now the Marvel-purchased Fleer Company can get to it, and their first card set, if I'm remembering correctly in the right order, was an X-Men Fleer Ultra set in 1994, which was 150 cards. Heroes, villains, the original team, crossovers, deceased X-Men. They're never deceased for long. Wolverine's
they don't have
greatest
count on the cards?
And, right, Wolverine's greatest battles as well.
I think this is when they started pushing me out of the market. I'm just like, I can't really afford a whole lot of these cards, and I think I just put the money towards comics. And they these cards started getting... I don't know if it's with this set, but I know eventually with the future sets, like, they have those weird... You're sort of, like, buying, like, a box instead of, like, a pack. And the cards are getting really thick.
Yeah, I'm not sure if these were there yet, but they're certainly on their way. Many of the same artists on this card set as that Marvel Masterpieces series, so I wouldn't be surprised if they were all commissioned at the same time. It's Dan Brereton, Joe Phillips, Ray Lego, Stelfreeze, Julie Bell, Sienkiewicz, Dorman, Palmer, Zek, Tristan, also Val Mayrick, Scott and Bo Hampton, and Kent Williams. Fleer published a 1994 inaugural Spider-Man set. That was 150 cards and 28 chases. I had a bunch of these, but I didn't go all out and buy the box. So I didn't have a complete set. But it was 9 pages of 9 grid tiles. And then team-ups, battles, friends, Spidey's origin told in 5 cards, and different Spider events as well as a checklist.
Yeah, I think I have most of these, too.
28 chase cards. Some were suspended animation cells, which were like plasticky transparent cards that were to push. There was a Spider-Man cartoon as well. There was holograms. There were 6 gold web foil cards. And all of the cards were Mark Bagley art, who was, you know, the big Spidey artist at the time.
Yeah, how could I turn that down? Bagley art?
In 94, we got the first Fleer Flare Marvel annual set, 150 cards. The whole Flare thing, it's like you said, you kind of get it in the box and they're thicker. It's on thick stock, but glossy. And what they did was they used classic art, the Flare process, as they touted it. It takes classic art and basically destroys it by softening the image and then jacking up the color and, like, the reflectivity. It's terrible.
Yeah.
1994... Fleer published Marvel Universe Series 5. 200 cards now, plus 23 chase cards.
See, I didn't even buy any of these.
Well, this was a good set.
Why.
The first 9, again, thinking in 9 card chunks, the first 9 page were freeze frames. They were singular cards all drawn by Pat Oliff. Then cards 10 through 90 were 9 block battles. Fatal Attractions, Maximum Carnage, drawn by Steve Lytle. Blood Ties, drawn by Jeff Johnson. Siege of Darkness, drawn by Sienkiewicz. Blood and Thunder by Tom Rainey. Fall from Grace, Walter McDaniel.
Wow.
Or was it Scott McDaniel? I forget which McDaniel.
Probably Scott McDaniel.
Crash and Burn, Tom Morgan, and Fall of the Hammer, the 2099 event, drawn by Ron Lim. Then there were X-Men cards, Spider-Man cards, Punisher, Midnight Suns, The Avengers, Cosmic Powers, Force Works, New Warriors, 2099, and then a bunch of random Marvel Universe characters. Also with suspended animation cards with the transparent. Art here, besides the guys I mentioned, by Steve Butler, Ron Lim, Chris Piccolo, Derek Robertson, Ken Lashley, Stuart Immonen, Mike Manley, Andy Kubert, Jan Dersima, Ron Frenz. This was a good set. The last set from 94 was a Fleer Marvel Masterpieces Series 3. 140 cards with 19 chase cards, of which I have 16.
Wow.
139 alphabetical good and bad guys and a checklist. All full bleed portraits painted by Greg and Tim Hildebrandt. They're famous for their Tolkien calendars and stuff through the 70s. In 1995, Fleer published the X-Men Fleer Ultra, which was the X-Men Fleer Ultra Series 2. 150 cards and 29 chases. There were mixed heroes and villains, and then there were individual X characters by teams, but they kept in mind the 9-card binder page, so you got like a team or two per page, even though they were single portraits. So like Alpha Flight were all together sequentially. The original X-Men, drawn by John Romita Sr. It was back when the X-Men had their gold and blue team stuff going on. Crossovers and greatest events and stuff. But the funny thing about this list was cards 141 to 149 were X-Men Spring Break, which what? Has the X-Men all in bathing suits on the beach doing various things.
No.
Painted by Louis Royo. Do you know him? Do you know Louis Royo?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why I'm thinking this is like those swimsuit calendar comics. This is what this is reminding me
except
of.
They didn't get this one checked, cleared by Marvel, and the brass apparently blew a gasket, and Buckley caught some flack for this one. I mean, it had Wolverine holding a hot dog on his claw, roasting it, you know, on an open fire. Pretty funny. The Chase cards were a 10-card foil, Sinister Observations, that was more about what was on the back than what was on the front of the card, and a 9-card foil set, Hunters and Stalkers, painted by Dave DeVries, as well as some more of those suspended animation cards. But the cards in the set, drawn by Dave DeVries, Boris Vallejo, and Julie Bell, the Hildebrandt brothers, Glenn Fabry, Bob Larkin, great bunch of creators. 1995 had the second series of the Flare Marvel Annual that again had 150 cards, but this time with 51 Chase cards, Power wow. Blast, Hollow Blast, Duo Blast, you name it. Again, it's heavy glossy stock with this Flare process, but this time they made not very good choices of images from the comics. I mean, they're just not dynamic looking images, and then they just make them worse with this Flare process, the Computo process. Moving right along, Fleer in 1995 did Fleer Ultra Spider-Man, which was 150 cards with 34 chases. And we got heroes and villains and legacy characters, milestones, team-ups, unlikely allies, and then cards 135 to 144 was another set that Buckley caught flack for that wasn't cleared, and it was Carnage USA that were painted by Gail Heimbach, and it depicted Carnage on the front destroying national landmarks.
What?
And on the back, it's like a postcard Carnage has sent to various Spider-Man supporting characters and what? Like giving them cryptic, horrible messages.
Oh.
Drawn by Julie Bell, Simon Bisley, Dave DeVries, the Hildebrandts, Mark Texeira, Louis Royo, and a bunch of guys I never heard of, too. A few more before I got out of this whole card business.
Wow, you stayed with it longer than I did.
I dropped out in 96, so let's finish up 95 here. There's three more sets in 95. Marvel Metal. Okay, that was, again, that was in those boxes that you didn't like. 138 cards. They were like the Fleer process, but with foil sparkliness added.
I got maybe a promo card of one of those.
Looked just as bad as the all flared up cards. Then the 95 Fleer Marvel Masterpieces were 151 cards with 32 chase cards. And this one I really liked also, as well as the other Masterpieces. They're really my favorites. The first 114 cards of the set were all three consecutive cards of the same character by three different artists. Right, so you got it, you know, and again, thinking of your 9-card grid, so you got like three Spider-Mans, three Reed Richards's, and three, you know, Thors, all consecutive to each other, right next to each other, but three different artist interpretations right next to each other. But there were only four artists that they were drawing from, though. Peter Scanlon, Dimitri Patalis, Cliff Nelson, and Dave DeVries. Then there were a bunch of artist picks that were all solo cards as well. 22 canvas cards, and they had these... All of the cards in the set also had a variant emotion signature series card that was gold stamped with the artist's signature across it, and then like a sound effect up the side of the card. It was weird. Like, I have a set, and then I have like a subset that's incomplete that has like all these different sound effects embossed into them.
Does one say Sweet Christmas going up the side?
No, it's like whoosh and stuff like that and crash.
Oh, okay.
Fleer and Skybox was now one and FLIR Skybox International in 1995 published the Marvel vs. DC cards. And they got real late notice on putting this set together and sort of had to rush it. It was only 100 cards, but 41 chase cards. Single characters and versus cards. Drawn by Ron Lim, Derek Robertson, the Q-Berts, Tom Morgan, Ron Wagner, Joe Quesada, Jimmy Palmiotti, Peter Krause, Jim Bellent, Lee Weeks, Barry Kitson, Paul Renaud, Stephen Butler, Glenn Orbick, Mike Waringo. Cool stuff. There were, in the chase cards, there were these 18 impact cards, 9 of them making a 9-card grid of the JLA versus Avengers, and 9 making a grid page of the X-Men versus the Teen Titans. Then there were 12 Holo FX cards that were versus images, a Marvel character fighting a DC character with like this little bit of like holographic effects. Like I have a Storm fighting Wonder Woman one, and like around Storm's hand is like a little bit of lightning with a hologram, and like Wonder Woman's bracelets are hologram, but the rest of it's just regular. Weird. But the interesting and really hard to get chase cards were these two Mirage cards, and they had an image that was kind of like a, I forget what you call them, but they kind of changed the image, like the image moved on it. So one had 3 images. It had Batman, Wolverine, and then the amalgamation of the two, Darkclaw. And the other one had Spider-Man and Superboy with the amalgamation Spider-Boy. Along those lines, in 1996, FLIR and Skybox International published the Amalgam cards, which was 90 cards with 24 chase cards.
Amalgam.
This was really an interesting set, and someday when we cover the whole Marvel vs. DC stuff as its own feature, which I think it deserves, I want to go a little deeper into these cards, because the first 41 were hero cards, and then cards 42 to 59 were like secrets of the Amalgam world, but they went really deep. They created all these fun false history continuity things of the Amalgam world, like Infinite Secret Wars and things like that, you know, where they'd combine stuff. Cards 60 to 89 were arch foes, and they had some connecting battle cards as well. Gary Frank, Ken Lashley, Derek Robertson, Carrie Nord, Walter McDaniel, Jim Bellent, Sal LaRocca, Stuart Immonen, Dave Gibbons, Jeff Matsuda, Brent Anderson, and Roger Cruz did the geese cards. Basically, all artists who worked on the Amalgam event were used because they were the only artists who knew what these characters looked like design-wise until they were published, you know? Then in 96, there was also from FLIR Skybox Marvel Onslaught Ultra.
Yeah.
I only bought 2 packs of this, but it's like art from the Heroes Reborn comics.
Oh.
Liefeld and Brett Booth and stuff, but then also some cards look like they've have the FLIR flare process to them done. Anyway, I just had a couple of them. And then the last set that I really collected was from 1996, and it was FLIR Ultra X-Men Series 3 from FLIR Skybox International, 100 cards with 12 chase cards. It had these 9-card grids for the first 99 cards, and then the 100th card was the checklist. And the fronts didn't really connect, but the backs did with a complete comic, like a sequential comic. On
weird.
Them. And the fronts, they had, like, each family of cards would be drawn by a different artist. So Weapon X was drawn by Glenn Orbeck, Department H by Ken Kelly, Second Genesis by Tom Kiffin, Japan by Julie Bell and Boris Vallejo, Allies by Dave Dorman, Madripoor by Mark Teixeira, Mojo World by Tom Fleming, Enemies by Cliff Nelson, The X-Men by Joe Jusko, The Age of Apocalypse by Mark Sasso, and Savage Beast by Brian Stelfreeze. It had Hall of Flash cards as chase cards that were all by the Hildebrandts. And like I said, that was the last set that I collected. I was out.
So you didn't come back for any of the... Like, I've seen occasionally, like, there was a set, and I'm like, oh, interesting.
Yeah, like I bought a pack or two maybe of like the Marvel women cards later on to see like what the art was, to see if it was original art. Occasionally I'll pick up a little something here or there, but as far as collecting a whole set, no, that was the last of them in 96.
Which it seems like when they have...
That's when they went bankrupt.
You see the sketch cards nowadays, that's the most interesting thing.
Right, which you get like one per box probably, or if you're lucky, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the next year they declared bankruptcy and things shifted for Marvel overall. And that probably had something to do with my interruption too. But the main thing is how bad those Fleer Flare things were. That was bogus. I gotta say. But I got six binders here.
As a kid, you're just like, what? What's going on here? And this is expensive.
Yeah, well, I was in my 20s, so it was part of my comic buying budget when these would come out. You know, there'd be about six sets a year probably that would come out.
That's a lot.
Four or five, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it was mostly just that Marvel Universe and Marvel Masterpieces, but except for the Spidey and the X-Men got the extra love because they had the cartoons and the toys.
Yeah, like two or three a year was fine. When you start getting more than that, it's like, that's a lot of cards.
But a lot of innovative techniques came out, a lot of printing processes that the comics benefited from. A lot of good artists from the comics were used. Those Art Adams cards are just fantastic to look at, amongst others, and the painted stuff as well, all those Jusco cards. And it was an interesting arena for Marvel to dabble in for a while, and I'm glad I picked up a bunch of the stuff and can enjoy it to this day. And then history-wise, it's interesting to see how many Marvel brass, of the current Marvel brass, came from these origins.
I know some people are really into the handbooks, but these cards were basically my handbook.
Yeah, sure. Like everything, though, I was always in it for the art.
Of course.
All right, that's another episode of Marvel Noise. Tune in next episode, and later this month we're going to have more Luke Cage, another era of the Thunderbolts begins, and Jerry McDade and I are going to get back to our coverage of the Tomb of Dracula series from the 70s, just in time for Halloween.
He always knows what to say.
Thanks for joining me, Kevin. Appreciate it. Fun to go through these cards with you. Wish we could look at the binders together.
I know. We'll be pointing at each card. Look at that Deathlok. Look at that. What's wrong with some of these cards? Or look at that. That's awesome. Darkhawk? Yeah. That's what we'd be saying.
So until the House of Ideas becomes only a House of Cards, make mine Marvel. Later.
Breaker, Breaker 19, this is Ulysses Solomon Archer on US 1. Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. My name is David Price. I am your host, and you are in my car.
Hey, true believers. Steve Ricker here, calling from the comfortable confines of my comic book crypt again. I've come across another sleeper title of old that made me face front with nostalgia when I came across it again in the annals of my long boxes, and I just had to share it with you. And this one is from 1981. It's Kazar the Savage. This was a great title, written by Bruce Jones with art by Brent Anderson, later of Astro City fame. And it featured Shanna the She-Devil and, of course, Zabu the Saber-Toothed Tiger. As Kazar's supporting cast. This series had great Savage Land stories with beautiful art, really fleshing out some of the races that inhabited the Savage Land and introduced a winged race residing in a previously unknown area within the Savage Land, which led for more exploration and taking Kazar out of his element, even though he was still in the Savage Land. 11 and 12 featured a memorable story with Belasco as the villain. He's the devil-like demon, and he took it upon himself to really mess around with Shanna. This book became one of Marvel's first direct sales books, along with Moon Knight, and often sported really nice wraparound covers with no UPC box to obscure any of the art. Issues 11 through 26 featured a great backup stories. Tales of Zabu, which really made the title another fun thing to pick up every month. These stories were also written by Bruce Jones, with the first four having art by Gil Kane, and the next 12 having Val Mayerik art, which is, he's no slouch himself. Brent Anderson left after issue 19, and newcomer Ron Frenz took over the art chores. He was often paired with Armando Gill on inks, who even penciled a couple of the next 10 issues as well, as he sort of further developed his heavy-handed style. Issue 19 also began a fun, sometimes dark storyline that lasted 8 issues, which brought Kazar and his crew to New York City and heavily featured Spider-Man as a supporting character. And this was a real fun storyline here, with Kazar being incapacitated for a while and the book focusing on Shanna and Spidey for a few issues. And in one nice sequence in issue 21, Shanna's kind of telling her story to Peter Parker, and he kind of becomes sort of serendipitously, innocently seduced by Shanna's natural beauty and her naivete and her plight, and they even kiss in the next issue. And that supporting that storyline wrapped up with issue 26, and Jones was gone from writing the title by issue 28, with Mike Carlin taking over scripting and then writing duties. The title got a bit silly and directionless at that point. You know, what, Mike Carlin writing silly books? With Kazar and Shanna marrying in issue 30, which was Friends' last issue with art. Paul Neary was added on art, and the Carlin Neary team ended with issue 34 a few issues later, with a cover that kind of mocked the classic Nick Fury outer space cover. It was a fun little title, and Kazar wasn't given another shot at a solo title until years later in 1997, with Mark Waid and Andy Kubert on the first 11 of the first 14 issues. And while the stories were somewhat interesting, and the art was beautiful page by page by Andy Kubert, the art really just didn't tell the story very well, and it didn't really flow in a nice way of kind of getting through a book. It was kind of a lot of effort to kind of get through it, even though the art page by page looked real nice. But of note, the Marvel Flashback Minus One issue of that series, also from 1997, which is sometimes called Kazar's Sibling Rivalry, was drawn by John Cassidy early on in his career, too. So, enjoy the old Kazar the Savage. It was a fun little title. Take it easy, guys. Have a good week. Bye.